His eyes were bright as a badger's. Sorry doesn't matter. We should be honest with each other. I have some questions for you, and you've got a few for me. Go ahead.
He was so direct I could only doubt his meaning. He wanted me to grill him, right now, and then he was going to grill me? He looked at me with pity and impatience. Certainly he'd expected better of Davy's brother.
Well, what do you want to know?
Why you live here, I said. It was the only thing I could think of. His eyebrows went way up, with pleasure, I noted, to my relief.
Sarah, he called, come meet Reuben. Pour him some coffee.
Before the sentence ended, a sheet was pulled back, and she moved across to the stove, a redhead girl about 14 in pants and a man's flannel shirt. Green plaid flannel. When she brought the coffee pot, I saw she had green eyes too, though she didn't aim them at me particularly.
Davy's brother Reuben,
Walzer said, as she set down three enameled cups and poured.
This is Sarah. Thank you, daughter.
She nodded to him and retired behind the sheets without revealing her voice. I'd have liked to hear it.
I live here because it's a cheap, safe place to wait for the world to change, Walzer declared. Sit straight there, Reuben. Carriage matters.
I sat straight. Is it changing the way you like, Mr. Walzer? He'd spoken, after all, of crumbling hills and rising seas. It might be a pretty long wait.
Yes, he said. I go out from time to time and have a look. It's coming around, Reuben. I take encouragement.
Well, I didn't know what to think. It gave me a picture of Walzer kneeling streamside, taking soundings with string and lead. Yet here we sat in the frozen core of winter, entirely beyond my depth. I asked next how he knew Davy.
Here's what happened. I went into Amadon for breakfast. It isn't far, and there's a not bad cafe there. The owner is Williams. I sat at a front table and ordered the steak and eggs and sat looking out the window. Have you been to Amadon?
No, Mr. Walzer.
The last town I know with a hitching post. No one uses them.
Don't you? He leaned forward.
Do I look like an eccentric to you?
You should have seen his brows. They were pointing right at me. I shook no.
Nor to Proprietor Williams, nor anyone else, he said. My eccentricity can be our secret. Mine, yours, and Davy's.
I nodded with ardor.
The telephone rang in the cafe. Williams answered. He's a good fry cook, but an unpleasant man. I heard the word Studebaker. Williams hung up and approached my table. There was a car parked out front, and he asked, was that my car? No, sir, it is not. Then he went back, and I heard him on the phone again. Not long, and my breakfast arrived. It's hard to do better than steak and eggs. When I looked out again, a county deputy was parked down the block. Reuben?
Walzer said confidentially.
Are you amused by trouble?
I must have looked blank.
You're in school, correct?
Not now.
When you were in school, he said, lowering his voice patiently, how did a person most often get in trouble?
Talking in class?
Talking in class. Reuben, were boys ever sent to the principal's office for a paddling when they were caught, once too often, talking in class?
Actually, in roofing, they got sent to the superintendent, Mr. Holgren, whose paddle hung on a wall under his diplomas. Varnished to a high gloss, it had the golden demeanor of prize decor. Yes, sir?
Did you ever see them sent away, thus?
I nodded.
How did you think of it? As it was happening.
I had no answer for him. He said,
you were glad it was happening to that other boy, not to you.
I did recognize some truth here.
Maybe you smirked a little, happy the principal was going to thump someone else, though you had whispered in class many times yourself. Don't be offended. I can stand your unwholesomeness, because in this way we are blood relatives. I sat in Williams' cafe, looking out at the deputy parked waiting for whomever owned the Studebaker. I was pleased enough to smirk, Reuben, although I didn't. A smirk looks terrible on the adult of the species. Yet I was pleased because someone was in trouble, and it was not me. Don't mistake this for regret. I have none. It pleased me to think the person in trouble didn't know it yet. He was in the same cafe, having breakfast, not knowing his day was almost over. Daughter, he called. Davy will be in. See about our dinner.
She emerged from her little room again. I heard tin plates, the kettle lid, other rattles. I'd have liked to help her, or at least watch her work, but Walzer talked on.
Most pleasing to me was that no matter the deputy's charge that day, he was surely waiting for the wrong person. Do you understand that, Reuben?
No, sir.
He should have been after the bearded fellow he could see through the front window eating steak and eggs,
Walzer said gleefully.
But he looked straight past me, you see. He was quite blind. In sight of wolf, he was hunting squirrel.
At this, praise be, the door woofed open and Davy stepped in, knocking snow off his boots. He looked at Walzer, then at me, as if to ensure I was still myself. He asked,
Sarah, you need some help with that?
It was hard to miss the smile she gave him.
Walzer beamed. Davy, my squirrel! Your brother's curious how we met. I'm just to the moment you rose from your table at Williams. Come finish the story.
Davy sat, sipped the coffee Sarah had poured earlier.
I'll just listen. You tell it, Jape.
So he finished it out, how Davy'd gone up and paid his bill, how he'd stopped beside Walzer's table to observe the street, then returned to the counter and inquired of Williams the whereabouts of the restroom, Williams pointing to the rear of the cafe. Seeing this, Walzer laid money beside his plate and left by the front door. He walked past the Studebaker, nodded to the deputy, rounded the corner and entered the alley where behind the cafe, Davy stood hunched in calculations. Talk ensued, during which Walzer was stirred by the boy's assurance under stress. Walzer believed in invented destiny, and invented some then and there. A quarter hour later, the pair of them were riding an overladen Fry into the hills above Amadon. It was too bad about the Studebaker, but a recently burst gasket had it leaking oil all over the place. Perhaps it was for the best. During this summation, Sarah had laid in that shack a feast of medieval plenty. She removed the stones atop the Dutch oven, setting them on the earth under the stove. The oven she carried to the table and unlidded before us, stepping back from the steam to show a knoll of sweet potatoes glazed with brown sugar encircled by sausages. She did this entirely without production, as though expecting no praise. Sure enough, Walzer talked right along. She produced half a round of black crust bread, baked no doubt in that same oven, and broke the bread in 6 pieces, which she laid on a checked cloth. Through all this, Walzer talked animatedly. I wondered how long she'd lived out here. What could she think of such a father? Though he wasn't without appeal, I looked at him, eyebrows rocketing now, at the part where Grumpy Fry carried both men into the hills. It was clear he was a difficult fellow to please. She refilled our cups and arranged our plates and tinware, receiving, I noticed, a long and thankful glance from Davy.
Now, Reuben, said Walzer, reaching for the yams, your story. Was Davy dropping breadcrumbs behind him that you followed so efficiently?
I lowered my head in panic. Not for a moment had I believed my narrative would be required. Also, the lateness of the hour suddenly landed on my shoulders. It had to be 2 in the morning. I guess I shut my eyes a moment.
Reuben, what are you doing?
I looked at him through twisting steam from the Dutch oven. He'd frozen as if detecting betrayal. Nothing, I said.
Are you praying over this meal I've provided?
No, Mr. Walzer. I'd forgotten to pray, though you may believe I felt like doing so now.
You are thanking God for the food, he said, when he did not give it to you. I gave it to you, and did so freely,
thank me.
I nodded. Call me Craven. You weren't there.
Thank me, then.
I looked at Davy, who was watching his plate. I said, thank you, Mr. Walzer. It looks like a good meal.
Absolutely it does,
Walzer agreed. He leaned toward me, congenial again. Two fingers, I noted, were missing from his left hand.
There's no need to wet your pants, Reuben. I forgive your impolite habit. Tell us how you came here.
We just came, I said. I wished he hadn't said that, about wetting my pants. I never had a predisposition towards pants wetting, but suddenly it seemed quite possible.
A long trip?
He prompted, ladling yams. Oh, yes, real long. We got a new Airstream trailer, I said, thinking he might find that interesting.
Been traveling a while, then, looking for Davy. Gone all over the place.
Well, no, we pretty much came straight here. He looked at Davy, who shrugged.
Straight to us, Reuben? Tell me how you happened to do that.
I saw he suspected Davy, that he might have given them away. I said, we didn't even mean to stop here. Our car broke down and we got snowed in.
So no one led you here?
He said. Well, the question was dismaying. Of course we had been led. Why did everyone keep bringing this up? We had leading by the bushel. The breakdown and the snowstorm had been leading. I could have told Walzer, along with Mr. Lurvy and August and Birdie and a bunch of state troopers. In fact, I thought sourly, even the putrid Fed had been part of the old rod and staff employed by the Lord to goose us along. Yet there sat Walzer, awaiting my reply, a man who bridled at the idea of God getting credit for so much as a meal on a plate. What kind of leading do you mean, Mr. Walzer? He looked at me with eyes from a dead photograph.
What kind did you receive, young Reuben?
I understood then that he would believe me if I told him the truth. Strangely enough, it was a scarier prospect than his disbelief. What would you have said? Would you have spoken up undaunted, like one of Fox's martyrs? I guess we had great luck, I said, and immediately there came a loathsome squeal from behind the bedsheets, and a weighty tumbling, the sheets themselves jerking horribly about. Then out sped some wild, leathery being, screeching in torment, banging off walls. Walzer roared, like the devil must at Christian cowardice. I remembered that other poor rat-fink, the Apostle Peter, how he denied the Lord and heard that rooster bellowing. This squealing fiend was my rooster. Indeed, it now came straight for me. I jerked my legs up to avoid it, feeling warmth just where you don't want to in times of panic. It zipped under the table and leapt up into the lap of Jape Walzer, where it became a small dark pig, a-tremble with terror.
Ah,
Walzer said, holding the pig firmly.
Ah, take a breath, little one. Ha ha, calm. Calm yourself. Such nerves.
You could see him trying not to laugh, trying not to startle the animal. I was trembling some myself, but it was just a young pig that must have been behind the sheets where Sarah lived. It had dark skin with milky pink saddle stripes and tufts of hair on its ears like a lynx, and it kept sniffing through its snotty nose while Walzer soothed it.
Sweet pig. Good animal. Yes, yes, a good-natured pig. Brave pig,
he said pleasantly.
A little bad dream. Something with big teeth and sharp claws. Yes, yes.
Without changing his tone, he added,
daughter.
Out came Sarah. Why in the world had she stayed in there, with a pig, instead of joining us for supper?
Please explain this disruption,
Walzer said. His voice was patient in a way that made me afraid. He was running his hands down the limbs of the pig, who had calmed so much as to appear dazed.
He was sleeping out of his box, sir,
Sarah replied.
I must have stepped on his tail. I'm very sorry.
anyone could hear her voice was worn to the contours of apology. I looked at her, meeting Waltzer's gaze, and it was easy to imagine her moments ago in her dim little room, spying the vulnerable tail. I peeked down at her shoes. Boy's boots.
"It wasn't my tail you damaged,"
Waltzer said, conversationally.
"You're right, sir,"
Sarah replied, addressing this next to the animal.
"I'm very sorry, Emil. It wasn't intentional,"
she added, at some risk to herself, it seemed. Waltzer hung on to her eye a moment longer, then turned to me. I heard Sarah step back and shut the curtains. Dreading to do so, I looked at Waltzer, but his eyes were alive and forgiving.
"Reuben, what are your plans?"
he asked. "My plans?"
"Yes, sir. What is it you want to do?"
"Tonight, Mr. Waltzer?" He smiled, scratching Emil gently around the ears.
"In your life," he said.
But I was so tired. I tried to think of a reply large enough for Jape Waltzer. Nothing came. My lungs had gotten shallower all through the night, and moreover, I'd gone and wet my pants after all, thanks to the pig, for my lap was soaking. "I guess breathe," I said. No doubt he could have taken this for impertinence, but he didn't. He spoke to the pig.
"His aspiration is respiration, Emil. He might do well to strive harder."
"What, Emil?
Are you hungry? Here is a sausage. Yes. Good pig, my little cannibal."
Davy spoke up at last. "Jape, Reuben has some lung trouble. That's what he means." He looked at me kindly. "It's just once in a while. Most of the time, I can't even keep up with him." Of course, it was the sort of thing said to appease the inveterate sickly. I still would have appreciated it, except it rekindled Waltzer's interest in me. He let the pig down off his lap.
"Is that right? I've heard of this condition. Tell me, is it hard right now to breathe?"
It sure was.
"Here, do this."
He sat up straight and drew in his deepest breath he could, opening his eyes wide to encourage me likewise. I straightened and inhaled. It sounded like a dozen shallow leaks from an inner tube. Waltzer leaned in.
"No, no, make the attempt. Make up your mind and breathe."
And he gave me another example of a man's functioning lungs, a suck of immense force and duration. You almost expected him to explode. I made another attempt. You have to understand, this was old ground to me. More than one teacher back in roofing had been convinced I was short of breath simply because I hadn't learned to do it properly, or because I didn't want it enough. How many asthmatics had been told in exasperated tones, "Just breathe"? Waltzer shook his head in wonder.
"How do you even live, boy?"
"It's usually better," I said. In fact, all this attention to my respiratory apparatus had made it self-conscious. It was shutting down valves all over the place. I said,
"May I please be excused, Mr. Waltzer?"
He said in evident disbelief,
"Are you strangling on me now, Reuben? Has the monster got you by the throat?"
I'll say this. I kept quiet at first, but these attacks have an exponential nature, doubling and quadrupling their hold. They push every advantage and are fearsome enough without some skeptic calling you a fake.
"Rube," Davy said, seeing my look, "you better lie down."
"Here, Reuben, this is nonsense,"
Waltzer said, about to try to help me again.
"Stop embarrassing yourself. Now, when I count three..."
"Shut up," I gasped. "Shut up and let me be." It was all the air I had. I paid for some more and added,
"Mr. Waltzer!"
I can't forget how the air in the cabin turned all spotty then, nor the scramble I heard, nor the broken bat sound which was my head striking the floor, though I didn't feel that until quite a bit later. Of all the dreams you ever had, which do you least hope to have again? For me, it was the man with the skin bag. The little devilish fellow who slugged my gut, harvested my breath, and bore it away on his shoulder. The moment of highest peril in that dream came when he crouched down, peering at my face. His eyes were windows through which I glimpsed an awful country. I don't like telling about it. The point here is that for a long while I walked in a gray place where I felt again that little man's presence. Across a landscape of killed grass and random boulders I moved, looking for something I needed. In the dream, I didn't even know it was my breath. I thought of it as a thing packed tight in a seamed bag. I knew who had it, and I knew I hadn't the strength to take it from him. Yet there I was in his country, a sunless place. The cold from the ground came up through my shoes. The boulders lay everywhere and cast no shadows, and they were the same color as the dead grass and as the sky. I smelled decay on the wind. Had Swede contrived to be along, she could have described it better. I'll say I had the sense of walking through an old battlefield upon which the wrong side had prevailed. It was the little man's country. I felt him approaching and lay down with my back against a boulder and shut my eyes to wait. He soon found me. It was colder every second, and the smell of decay strengthened and mixed with sulfur as I heard his nimble steps. Even shut-eyed, I knew what he would do. Now he'd crouch, and I heard the creak of his boots as he did so. Now he'd lean down and look in my eyes. My lashes felt his breath.
"Reuben," he whispered, "look at me."
What choice did I have? I opened my eyes. Jape Walzer's face searched mine, as I hope never to be searched again. I couldn't say a thing. I was confused, wondering about the skin bag. It seemed to me Walzer must have it, and that he wanted something more besides. I wilted back from him, but he leaned ever forward. I saw we were outside the cabin, and that I lay against it in my coat, and that Walzer was crouched in the snow against a night of misty stars.
"Ah, you're breathing now," he said.
He smiled to reassure me, but in his eyes I saw the same dead country through which I'd just come.
"Davy's getting fry. He'll take you back, if you can ride."
I nodded, dreading to speak aloud lest Walzer change his mind. He pressed closer to me.
"You know not to tell of this place," he said.
I said, "Yes, Mr. Walzer." Then Fry cantered up out of the night. His hooves made lit white caps of snow, and he laid back his head as though angry at bridle and bit, for Davy had interrupted his sleep.
"Come back and see us, Reuben. I'll teach you how to breathe," Walzer said quietly.
Davy lifted a leg over Fry's withers and slipped off frontwise. He gathered me up and carried me to the horse and heaved me aboard, then rocked himself up behind. I honestly had no breath. Fearing another faint, I leaned back into my brother as though his were the mighty everlasting arms sung about, and he reached around to mind the reins and keep me upright. Fry arched his neck and chewed his bit at carrying us, but Davy ignored all complaints, and we trotted up out of Walzer's valley. Minutes gone from there, Davy asked, "Was I feeling better?" I was. In fact, across parts of that homeward trip, I actually slept. But it was the good kind, free of bouldered grayscapes, I mean, and robbers who had you on their ground. Winning Her Hand. At my age, Teddy Roosevelt's lungs would lock down so tight his father would gallop his fastest horse down gaslit New York boulevards with the boy astraddle before him. Mr. Roosevelt was called Greatheart, and his idea was to impel air down Teddy's throat by their very speed. This fusion of hoofbeats, daring, and midnight mercy romanced Swede, but to me it spoke less of romance than of desperation. I thought of panicked Roosevelts as Teddy strove for wind. I imagined a cycle wherein his lovely mother, at the first tightness of breath, propped the boy upright and stroked his cheek and told him gentle stories of exotic pet animals, llamas and guinea fowl, and allegiant shaggy knee-high ponies, or of the glorious lavender moths her brother, Captain James, had collected in South America, moths with phosphor wings a foot across before which natives knelt in worship. It was Mrs. Roosevelt's belief such tales could turn her son's mind to pleasing things and relax his crimping passages. At times it worked, at others not. Then Greatheart, the bearded patriarch, would rise from bed and stride to the stables to saddle his fleet charger, return for his son, now bundled in wool and furs, and dash away in the night with Teddy gaping at the wind. Did this method work for me? Maybe so. I do recall getting my breath as Fry plunged on with what seemed overconfident speed. Maybe the wind was forcing itself down in, or maybe I was just relieved to be away from Waltzer. But when we rose over the last hill and trotted down toward Roxana's, I felt sufficiently safe from horrors to ask Davy when I could see him next. He wouldn't say. He let me off Fry a few hundred yards back of the barn. The slopes to the west were just showing blue to where you thought of calm seas. In less than 2 hours, they'd be plain snowy hills, and I'd have to get up and candle eggs. As it turned out, though, Swede did the candling. I woke with a jump and a rotten fever, with Roxana's cool hand against my forehead. You know how a room smells with fever? I squinted while she pulled the shades. "It's still awfully bright," I told her. The light felt like two dirty thumbs in my eyes. She opened a wardrobe, took down a quilt, stepped up on a chair, and tacked it over the window.
"Better, darling?"
"Uh-huh," I said.
"Could you drink a little cocoa?"
I shook my head.
"Reuben?"
"No, thank you." No doubt I sounded like some boy choking. She came and bent over me, put her hand on my forehead again. She listened to my breathing. I squeezed my eyes shut.
"I'll get a cool cloth," she whispered. "We'll whip that fever."
I nodded. To my great relief, she went from the room, and I wiped my eyes and settled down. The easy way she asked that.
"Better, darling?"
I don't know why, but I could hardly answer her. Sleep that day was a warm pool into which I dove and stayed, sporadically lifting my head to sense the world. Roxana entered with a bowl of beef broth, and later with buttered saltines. Swede stood by the bed a few times, waiting for me to open my eyes, which I didn't. Once I surfaced to the rattle of papers and found her on a chair next to the bed, pretending to rub out some words on a page. Her regret at my awakening was also counterfeit. She happened to be waist-deep in a new sundown episode. Barely conscious, I listened like some drunken editor. You'll recall how Sonny started as ramrod lawman, then found himself compelled to questionable action and had lately grown into the best of misunderstood outlaws. This new chapter placed him in an undiscovered valley high in the mountains, a snakeless Eden and matchless hideout. Its meadows were the rippled green of the resting sea, fed by springs and by a vigorous brook, twisting down to a pool with a floor of polished stones. Moreover, this valley had but one entrance, a steep slot through canyon walls which one tucked stick of dynamite could obliterate forever. Yes, Sonny owned a stick. In fact, he had tucked it already, back in a crevice away from rain. Should trouble threaten, he could merely strike a match and seal himself in paradise forever. I'll admit that even in my groggy state, this seemed a lot like Lassiter's condition in Riders of the Purple Sage. Swede didn't mind the observation. She said other writers had told this story also, and that not even Zane Grey was the first. She said it was such a true story, it needed recurrent tellings so as not to fall out of circulation completely. She asked whether it would be wrong for someone to write a story about pirate gold buried under an X, since Mr. Stevenson had done it already. Of course not. Well, secret valleys with sealable entrances were just the same, Swede said. Places and things that were so real in the world, they were often disbelieved. Sonny, anyhow, was holed up in this pretty gorge with the dynamite placed. He hadn't set it off because first he wanted his wife up there with him. I was a little bewildered about the wife business, given Sonny's undefined connections to various past ladies. But boy, I was tired. I didn't bring it up. In fact, at roughly this point, I drifted off again. When finally I woke of my own doing, the blanket over the west-facing window was shot with orange pinpricks. The day was over, the fever whipped, and no one had come to steal my breath. I washed up and went downstairs, sticking out my chest like Horatius. How quickly I'd come to expect Roxana to make a big deal of me, and how kind she was not to disappoint. At my appearance, she smiled, pressed her palm against my forehead, a sensation I enjoyed, remarked on my sturdy constitution to recover so fast, and introduced me to a bowl of vegetable soup. Sweet ate too, while Roxana worked in the kitchen beside us, thumping up crust for a pie. Things were close to perfect. "When's Dad coming home?" I asked. "This evening," Roxana said, checking the clock. "He called earlier. He's sure anxious to see you both." "How did it go with Mr. Andreessen?" "He didn't say much. I guess there's no big news." She rolled out that crust in about 6 strokes and laid it across a metal pan. "So they didn't find Davy?" "Not as of this morning." "Well, where do you suppose he is?" It was a little mean, my persisting this way. I only asked because I knew the answer and felt smug knowing it. Maybe it was my small-hearted revenge against Dad, my way of suggesting he hadn't been led to go off with Putrid after all. Then Roxana turned to me with an encouraging smile, and I saw that she was scared for Davy. Scared for him, though she'd never met him, and instead of smug, I only felt underhanded. "We have to be steadfast," she said now. "We have to have faith, you two. That's all." You see, she'd begun to use Dad's language. You notice something like that. In watching her, I noticed, too, that she was wearing earrings, little gold hoops, and that while in no way impatient, she seemed eager to get the pie in the oven and her hands washed and the countertop clean where she'd rolled out the crust. Sweet had been eating in unusual quiet. Out of nowhere, she said, "If Dad says we have to go back home, I'm not going to let him." "Neither am I," Roxana replied. I looked at her quick, but she was scrubbing the counter, all business and not about to meet my eye. We didn't even see who dropped him off. It could have been Andreessen or some underling. Who cared? What we saw was Dad standing in his overcoat between the 2 gas pumps. At his feet was the small cardboard suitcase he called his overnight grip, and he was whisking his hands together, gazing up at the house. Roxana was upstairs, so it was only Sweet and me at the living room window. Of course, we were bouncing and waving like a pair of gibbons. But Dad somehow didn't see us. He stood there between the pumps, looking up at the front gable. He was changed from before. We saw it straight off and quit our bouncing. His expression was curiously buoyant and alien to us. He peered up at the gable like the most hopeful yet constrained boy you ever saw, a boy on his birthday morning, scared to get out of bed for fear everybody'd forgot. "What's the matter with him?" asked Swede. "Why isn't he coming in?" "Shh!" She grabbed my shoulder, but kept her eyes on Dad. I couldn't believe it. Now she had the buoyant expression. She'd caught it somehow. "Good grief," I muttered. Swede was squeezing my shoulder, transfixed by Dad, who was smoothing his hair back with his left hand. Now he looked critically at his shoes, straightened the lapels of his overcoat. It was maddening. I started for the door, but Swede had my shirt in her hard little fist. At last, Dad resolved to come in. Forgetting his grip by the pumps, he came up and knocked at the door, just as though he'd never seen the place before. "Come on," I told Swede, but still she held me back. "Let Roxana," she said. "But it's Dad." "Let Roxana," hissing at me. For now we heard Roxana descending stairs in a tremendous rustle, shoes skidding across linoleum, then slowing into sight. and I understood. I stopped flat foot. Roxana was in a deep blue dress, her hair softly curled in front. The Swede and I were certain of being her favorite people in all creation. We had the sense of being elsewhere as she glided past. I smelled perfume. That was a first, perfume in somebody's house. I'd only ever smelled it in church. Roxana went on to the door, and we shamelessly flowed along in her wake, staying back just far enough to remain unseen. Though I suspect we could have been two gibbering savants and yet accomplished that. When Dad stepped inside, still wearing that weightless expression, Roxana reached and took his hand. I didn't hear what she said, but can see their hands touching. Not a passionate clasp, but an easy, timeless transaction, as old as scripture. Then Dad's hand let go, and for just a moment encircled Roxana's waist. He was laughing. And when he turned to us, he'd never appeared stronger or more like himself or more capable of stepping up to what might be required. That very night, Dad packed up his clothes and moved out to the Airstream. I didn't fret, for it was plain now that something was forged between them and no abrupt partings were likely, but it confused me. Following his lead, I started stacking shirts in my own suitcase, but Swede came in and crouched beside me. "We're not moving out there, only Dad," she said. "How come he is?" "It's for honor," she said. "It's a declaration you like to hear about your own father," and I was pleased by the confident way she made it. "Oh, good. He's still going to come into the house in the daytime, but he's going to sleep out there." There seemed to be something going unsaid here, though I didn't know how to reach whatever it was. I'd already asked the only question, "How come?" and had my answer. Swede said, "He told me he wants to make sure the heater's working in the trailer. Remember that night it got so cold?" "Uh-huh. But it's really just for honor." She was pretty proud to have figured this out. I was proud of her, too. I would have believed the heater story for sure. It raised a question, though. "Don't you think we should move out with him, then?" Swede hadn't thought of that, I could tell. "I don't think it matters," she said. "It matters for Dad," I pointed out. "Well, he's the one who loves Roxana." Surprisingly, I was unembarrassed by such talk. "Well, so do I love Roxana. So do you, Swede." She gave me an "Oh, Reuben" look. "Well, talk to Dad about it then, if you're so determined." But I never did mention it to him. I feared a protracted discussion of honor, embroiled in deception as I was. Honest, I came about this close to getting Dad alone and telling him the works. I never wanted to confess so badly in my life. What kept me from it wasn't my promise to Davy, either. It was my intact bewilderment over Dad's having gone off with Andreessen. Most of 3 days he'd been gone, and what had come of it, anyhow? "I just liked it better when Mr. Andreessen was the enemy," I complained finally. Back in the barn, jacking up the Airstream to lie level so Dad needn't sleep at a tilt. He was kneeling at the ratchet, squinting the length of the trailer. "I don't see what's changed," I said. Dad got up and leaned into the trailer, checking the bubble on a wood level he'd set inside. "You even told him we were enemies, right to his face. Remember that?" I asked reproachfully, beyond my depth and knowing it, yet unable to shut up. "All right," Dad said. "Let's take stock. Why exactly is Mr. Andreessen our enemy? Because he's a bad fellow?"
"He wants to stick Davy in prison."
"And how come?" Dad said. "No, quit that squirming. How come?"
for what he did,
I replied eventually. Davy's in the wrong, then?
He might be.
A moment later. You aren't sure, though? I shook no. Dad let me stew while he reversed the ratchet and let the trailer sink an inch. He checked the bubble again and returned to the jack and brought it up a millimeter or two. And while he messed thus, Tommy Baska's last moments reappeared to me, and the bafflement in his face as he scrambled bellywise over the floor. Okay, I said.
What?
Davy did a wrong thing. Dad raised his eyebrows.
Yet you want him to escape consequences?
Yes, sir.
Consequences represented by Mr. Andreessen, who becomes,
Dad caught my eye,
our enemy.
This, of course, was the indefensible truth. It was also incomplete, having recently become acquainted with Davy's new life and his compadre, Jape Walzer. I realized he hadn't got away from consequences by any means. But Dad said,
Look, Reuben, I want the same thing as you. Davy free and clear. If you like Mr. Andreessen better as an enemy, then keep him one. Maybe that's your job as a boy. As a brother, my job is different.
How come?
Because I'm the dad. I have to heed the Lord's instructions.
I hadn't any comment to this, but felt myself opposite to the Lord in some way, which was worrisome.
Dad asked, You remember what the Lord said about enemies?
In fact, I did remember some passage about enemies. Once sick of whiners, the Lord caused the earth to crack open like an old bun, and a crowd of them fell right in. And how about the prophet Elijah, slaughtering 400 priests of Baal in one afternoon? Then there were the twisted fellows of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the time before that when God killed pretty much everyone in the world except Noah's family. The Old Testament, boy, it suited me.
Love your enemies, Dad said. Pray for those who persecute you.
He would pick those verses.
Rats, huh?
He said. Davy came back that afternoon. I was on some errand and looked up to the hills. He was exactly where he'd been the first time, though he sat a different horse. Again, I didn't dare wave. I did raise my hand to my eyes, as though shading off sun. At this, Davy turned the horse, a paint, and started working round the side of the hill as before. That night he was waiting for me behind the barn.
Hey, Natty,
he started, but I shushed him. Dad was sleeping in the trailer now. We couldn't afford a whole lot of nattying this close to home, if the nervous paint horse were even to nicker. Davy gave me a hand, and I slipped up behind him.
Jape's gone tonight, he whispered when we gained some distance.
To call this welcome news didn't touch it. Glad as I'd been to catch sight of Davy, I dreaded seeing Mr. Walzer again. Back in the house, I'd gone to my room, and at supper time told the barefaced lie that my stomach was sick. Actually, it was just empty, but I couldn't go down and sit across from Dad with that man Walzer in my proximate future. What if my pipe seized up? What if he tried teaching me to breathe again?
He had to go pay a man, Davy explained. Some debt he owed. He won't be back for a couple of days.
Can you come home, then? Come home with us, since he's gone?
This brought a silence, during which I remembered a salient fact. Davy wasn't scared of Walzer the way I was. Davy wasn't his hostage, but remained by choice. He called him Jape, for goodness sakes.
Nope, said my brother at last. Besides, what about Sarah? You think I should leave her alone?
Sarah was another fact I'd forgotten about.
Bring her along, I suggested, hopelessly.
That, said Davy, grinning so I could hear it, might be the worst idea you've had in quite a while, Rube. So we rode on. The paint horse took us up at a walk, round the first hill, then on as before, through treed valleys and choked washes and across flanneled hillsides, none of which a person could honestly see on account of the clouds which had got between us and moonlight. I recall the quilted jolts of that ride, the radiant warmth of the horse's rump, and the sulfury odor of Davy's coat, and I recall the black remorse that flapped down and perched on me as we rode, for this time I was sneaking out on Dad. You can embark on new and steeper versions of your old sins, you know, and cry tears while doing it that are as genuine as any. What else exhausts like sustained deception? I don't know how the true outlaw does it. In the coming weeks, I was to make that ride with Davy 3 more times. Not once did I come close to being nabbed. Not once did Swede so much as roll over when I slipped past her door. One night, skittering the barn, I did hear Dad praying aloud in the airstream, talking, laughing, asking questions of the Lord as though it had been you or me or Mr. De Cuellar in there, and I had to fight an ache to go straight to him and admit the weaselly nature I was fast developing. Yet even then, Davy was waiting in the dark not 100 yards away. I could hear the stamp of the paint, who seemed always a little goosey. Now Davy would be leaning forward, rubbing the horse's ears, giving to the animal of his own confidence. How could I not go out to him? I told myself we might yet reach a place where Davy would agree to come home, that the things I was learning at Walzer's table might be of value in my brother's redemption. Also, I had the common weakling's fantasy, imagining myself venerated in some golden future. Say, that's Reuben Land, who went into the Badlands at the age of 11 and found his outlaw brother. I thought of the admiration people like Bethany Orchard would bear me, the way they would seek my company, as if I were that pilgrim Sinbad come in off the water. Tell us about it, Reuben Land. And indeed, I did learn some things, many of which I've had to grow into. We saw old man Finch, I told Davy, as we rode through the hills. It was the day we left. He was out in the wind. He could just barely stand up. Well, that old souse, Davy cheerfully replied. But after talking with Dad, it was plain to me Davy had done a grievous thing. Don't misunderstand. I backed my brother all the way. Yet it had come to mean something, whether he felt anything like repentance. I pressed awkwardly in. Couldn't help but feel sorry for him. The paint horse stepped along at a bright pace. Davy said, "Don't you do that, Rube. Don't you recommend regret to me. It's no help." I wasn't saying anything. Say I did regret it. What good does it do? I have to go on from here. He kneed the paint to a quick trot. I grabbed his waist to stay on. Another ride, we got talking about Sarah. She's not really Walzer's daughter. He got her from a fellow in Utah, Davy said. Got her? What was that supposed to mean? The fellow gave her to him. So Mr. Walzer's like her godfather? I said. We ourselves had godparents, August and Bertie Schultz, in fact. I'd often been comforted to think that should a boiler or something tip over on Dad at the school, we'd go live with August and Bertie instead of some orphanage. Do you know how many times I read the Classics Illustrated version of Oliver Twist? Orphanages were a bad deal. I don't think that's it exactly, Davy said. Well, fellas don't just give their kids away. This was 5 or 6 years ago, he went on. Sarah remembers her dad. Well, was he dying or something? We plodded ahead. This particular night was fair as you could want. Not cold, the sky glutted with stars, yet all felt stained or soon to be. Was he dying? I asked again. For as I know, he's still alive. He just gave her away? Sarah doesn't seem to like him much. That I could believe. All I know, Davy said, seeming way too dispassionate about it, is that she's Jape's daughter for now. When she's old enough, she's supposed to marry him or something. That's what he told me. I'm raising myself a wife. Raising a wife? I sat the paint's rocking haunches and sifted that idea around. It was pretty abhorrent and only got worse as Sarah came more fully to mind. I remembered her now in relentless detail, her red hair bound back under a kerchief knotted at her fuzzy nape, her tired voice explaining the accident with the pig Emil, her settled grace in serving us, moving around the cabin with a woman's assurance. Now I'd gone and glimpsed her future, and it looked about as promising as Emil's. It made me scared and hot. That's the pukiest idea in the world, I declared.
Raising a wife? Why doesn't he go out and get one like everybody else does?
Davy said.
Why don't you ask him that yourself? Did you ask him?
Nope. We walked a heavy 50 paces before I said,
So he does scare you.
Davy pulled the paint horse to a stop. We were alongside a hilltop, and the moon was just rising out. It sure threw a lot of light for less than half a moon.
He doesn't scare me, Davy said.
I don't think he scares me, Rube. I just listen close when he's around.
You listen?
The horse nickered and threw his mane a little.
What for?
I asked.
I don't know. A sound to his voice. When he's there, I listen close, Davy replied. He seemed about 10% annoyed with me.
It isn't the same thing as afraid.
Is Sarah afraid?
Hard to say.
Look there.
Davy pointed to our left.
See him? An owl hunting? Look at that. You can see his shadow.
Yeah, I said. No, I couldn't see him. Seemed like I couldn't ever see what Davy saw, nor hear the things he heard. It was the old story. I wondered again just what he listened for when Mr. Walzer was around. Walzer showing up in my mind just then, chewing a piece of red sausage.
Hard to say,
Davy mused as the paint got moving again, just in time, for the stillness was working the cold up my ankles.
But Sarah's real smart. She should be. I'd say she probably is.
Afraid, he meant. But Davy was right. It was hard to say. You have to remember, Sarah had been raised these 5 years by Jape Walzer, and before that by a man degenerate enough to give away his little girl. She wasn't accustomed to conversation as you and I think of it.
Did Mr. Walzer show you his fingers?
She inquired during my second visit. He hadn't made a point of it, but I remembered. The index and middle fingers to his left hand gone from the roots up.
He amputated those fingers himself,
Sarah declared. Her eyes were an arresting, unreadable green. Suspecting I was being made foolish, I looked at Davy, who was tilting his chair back, holding coffee in an enameled cup.
He did, honestly, Sarah said. He made me watch.
How come?
So I'd learn.
To cut off fingers?
Sure, my voice may have been a little high. It seemed radical instruction.
No, it was my fault,
she said, apparently an explanation.
But how come he did it?
They got mangled up in a chain.
Now that she started, she seemed against continuing. She used short, reluctant declaratives.
We were towing a car to a lake. He wanted to dump it in. He had me driving. The chain came loose. My foot slipped off the clutch while he was hooking it back up.
Talk about abstaining from detail. Can you imagine the mileage someone like Swede would have gotten from such a grim episode? Except, as Sarah had already pointed out, her penalty for the slipped clutch was being forced to watch Jape Walzer take a hatchet and lay the ruined fingers across a stump. Perhaps the sight depressed narrative ardor. Urged, she revealed these particulars. Jape rolled his left sleeve to above the elbow. He laid the hatchet blade first in a saucepan into which he uncorked whiskey. Sarah he stationed with paper sack on a three-legged stool next to the stump. He took the fingers separately with two clean strokes, pausing to blow after the first, but not cursing or making utterance. He sweated plenty, but it was only sweat, not blood, nor did his hair turn white or his mood turn permanently for the worse. He did make Sarah dispose of the fingers, though. She had to pick them up in her own and drop them in the paper sack. She didn't want to, but Jape told her to get it done before he was finished, or there would be punishment. He was busy at that moment with needle and suture. She picked up the canceled digits and threw them, sack and all, in the crackling stove. I woke close to noon, short of breath, and with reinstated fever. Woke from a rolling, mutter sleep, when Dad came in my room and took my hand.
Let me hear you breathe,
he said. I sucked up what I could.
Pretty short, my friend. Let me get some water boiling. Do I have to?
I was hot. Steam would poach me alive. I could breathe well enough to smile, and did so like some begging dog.
All right, let me see if Roxanne has got an aspirin somewhere.
He smiled back, and I saw he was wearing good clothes. his suntan khakis and a blue chambray button-down. He was clean-shaven, and his hair was combed back, and he looked better tended than usual, though at this moment he also looked anxious, leaning forward to lay a hand on my brow. "Dad, is it Sunday?"
"Nope, Thursday."
"You're all dressed up."
"Oh, well."
He looked at me as though I'd thrown him a hard one, which surprised me, as did his decision a moment later to swing away.
"Reuben, I've decided to court Roxana. What do you think of that?"
I thought it was perfect, of course, though a foregone conclusion, even to a dull study like myself. He seemed pleased with my approval.
"You understand? As a courting man, I ought to look my best."
"You look great," I told him. He did, too. His shirt cuffs were rolled back smooth, and his hands and forearms looked ropey and fast, even at rest.
"All right, then," he conjectured. "What do you think of my chances?"
"Your chances?"
"Of winning her hand."
That he would put such a question to me so directly, well, it sat me right up. I felt older, packed with consequence, and also cautious lest I say something dumb.
"How's it going so far?"
Straight-faced, but with a shine back of it, he said,
"I believe she regards me respectfully."
Well, he had to gauge his chances better than that. He had to remember how happy she'd been when he got back from his outing with Mr. Andreessen. He had to remember the press of her hand when he came in the door. I sure remembered it, and it wasn't even my hand that got pressed.
"Oh, it's more than respectfully,"
I said, and started to tell about the exchange we'd had when Roxana was making the pie. How Swede said she wasn't going to let us leave no matter what, and Roxana replied,
"Neither am I."
But Dad fended off this encouragement with a question.
"Did you like being here with her while I was gone? You and Swede?"
I nodded.
"I thought you did. I'm glad."
He stood up.
"I like it myself."
He really did look good, a clean-shaven, courting man with quick arms and steady eyes. He had to know that Roxana loved him already, but he wouldn't have me pointing it out. Who could blame him? No doubt Dad had thought his pursuing days long over. Why sprint through such sweet country? How often does a man get to use phrases like winning her hand? And it wasn't just talk. He truly meant to win it. He set himself toward her like an athlete. He slept in the cold trailer and spent most of each day there. He stopped entering the house casually. He knocked for admittance. Swede and I missed his constant presence, yet when he arrived, the very light seemed to change, like light bouncing in off June maples. And Roxana, always lovely now. Roxana, at this knock, would look around at Swede and me as though all this were as unnecessary as it was wonderful, and she'd go to the door, and there Dad would be in his best clothes, suit coat, often a hothouse carnation in hand. He assumed nothing. There was a poor nursery west of Grassy Butte, an old man's hobby, a little morgue of a Quonset greenhouse. A feeble flower is better than none, and it was my impression, for I accompanied him there more than once, that even that greenhouse became better lit and warmer for Dad's frequent visits. The old man in baggy brown pants and suspenders liked to tell Dad he was nuts, that romance was a detour men took from whatever work was theirs in life. Dad agreed with everything in the most cheerful fashion, and the old man sold him flowers for next to nothing. One day we walked in from the blistering wind, and there was a ruined guitar propped in a corner like a dead plant. Though scaly and fret-worn, its top had a courtly arch like a violin's, with S-shaped holes each side of the strings. The old man asked, "Was Dad a musician?"
"No."
The old man picked up the guitar in his blemished hands and turned it on its axis. He pointed out a wide crack running the length of the back, also a place where the binding at back and side had pulled apart. Dad admired the instrument, repeating he was no musician. The old man informed us the guitar had been made by a revered Spaniard late in the previous century. The top was carved from a piece of clear cedar. Rotating it again, he displayed yet another crack, a hairline fault high on the neck. He'd been playing songs for his wife, the two of them picnicking the summer of 1922 on a broad rock in the middle of a stream. There'd been drought, but no one knew the term Dust Bowl then, or had any notion of what was coming. And he stooped for a bottle of soda and smacked the guitar headfirst on the rock. fearing the neck would break off entirely, he'd unstrung the instrument and not played it since. A timid decision, the old man said. He regretted it. He flexed the guitar in his two hands. The neck seemed strong. Fix the back and side, he told Dad, and the guitar would play. Dad replied for the third time that he was no musician, though now his face was alight, and he held the guitar carefully and looked at the old man as though he were some gruff uncle who couldn't be bothered to look back. Boy ready. Not to linger on it, but I was getting worse, a fact that speeded in the night Swede volunteered to wash dishes without me. Go up to bed, she said, taking my plate and glass out of my hands. That wheeze is awful.
Thanks. You want me to boil some water?
Sure.
You want Dad?
I did, but he disappeared suddenly. I was too tired to wonder where.
You want me to pound your back?
Not right then, I didn't.
Go on up,
she said, reaching down the vinegar. But I didn't want to go upstairs alone. I wanted to sit on the bottom step where I could see Swede. I wanted to listen to her talk. Upstairs, there'd be nothing to hear but my own gaspy noises. Also, the stairs looked steep.
Tell me about Sunny.
I took a breath.
Up in the secret valley.
But she turned on me, not to be fooled with. I went. I recall the climb as tougher than my ascent to the hills that first time seeking Davy. Tougher by far. I leaned in the dark stairwell to rest. Down in the kitchen, Swede banged and rinsed. I climbed a few stairs. Of course I'd had times like this before. Of course I expected to bounce back. But 4 days had passed, and I knew it was bad to still be waiting. For the bounce, I mean. The stairwell now began to turn slowly, as if dangling. I sat on the steps and dozed against the wall.
Reuben?
That was Swede's frightened whisper, there in the cold dark. I had just entered a dream about freezing in the west bedroom at August Schultz's.
Can you hear me, Rube?
Smelling brine, I opened my eyes. She was halfway up the steps, holding a steaming pan and looking at me in alarm.
Oh, I said. Are you okay?
Sure.
My gosh, Reuben, couldn't you even make it upstairs?
I got to my feet, embarrassed and scared.
Sure, I just got tired, see?
With Swede behind me, I held to the railing and went up briskly enough the rest of the way.
I brought you some steam. Here's a towel,
she said, stuffing pillows behind me on the bed. Steam was the last thing I wanted, being already muzzy with fever. But unless I gained more air, I was afraid of falling asleep again, and right in front of Swede, who was pulling up a chair.
Should I read to you now?
She asked. She stayed a long time, reading Psalms against fear and twice rising to reboil the brine. But my lungs wouldn't loosen. I remember the room veering slowly, my eyesight tilting spot-struck around. Swede pounded my back without result. I asked where Dad was, and she said, gone off with Roxana, she didn't know where. I'd wished he'd come sit by me and pray. The muscles in my legs and chest needled. Dr. Noakes had described to me